Welcome to the third session with Dr. Jack Opperle on four women you should never forget. Today's topic is Rosa Parks, the commuter. And Jack will open us with prayer. Thank you.
Let us pray. Gracious and abiding God, we give you thanks for those who light the way, especially those who light the way with a sense of joy, sense of purpose, and beyond that, a sense of humility. Today, as we ponder your servant, Rosa, speak to us. Through Christ our Lord, amen. David Brinkley, the historian, not the newscaster, the historian, has said that Rosa Parks is one of the most curious people in all of history. And the curiosity that he assigns to her is the fact that she was not someone who sought the position that she ultimately found herself in. She was literally a person who was sort of prodded and shown and then called to do what it was that she ultimately did in December of 1954. And so we look today at Rosa Parks, who was born in Tuskegee, Alabama in 1913. Her dad, Mr. McCauley, Edward McCauley, was a carpenter. He was also a stonemason. He was a man who traveled the country in light of his trade. And more than anything else, he was not a very good dad. Conversely, her mother, Leona, was a school teacher. And she was dedicated to not only her craft, but also her responsibilities and her privileges as a parent. And so this child grew up in a kind of dysfunctional home, where dad was more often absent than present, and where mom was the primary motivator. In the home that was shared with the maternal grandparents, early on, Rosa Parks began to learn some lessons. And those lessons grew right up out of the Bible. Every day in that family, at supper time, a prayer was spoken, and then some scripture was read and applied. The prayer always asked for safety, for insight, and for the ability to forgive. The lessons from the Bible always had to do with what ultimately she called a social mandate. Rosa Parks, as a little child, began to see, because of her grandfather, a relationship between the book and how one lived in the real world. Daily devotions were a part of her life from the very beginning. The family lived in poverty. It was a time in the culture and the economy of Alabama when agriculture was at one of its lowest productive levels. And so they learned to do without. However, her grandfather, once again, was a person who was resilient in the face of adversity. And as a result, he took jobs of every kind in order just to provide some level of comfort for not only his wife and daughter, but also for her husband and, of course, his granddaughter. Eventually, it just became too much. And Rosa decided to move to Abbeville, Alabama, to live with her husband's family. While she was there, she encountered a family that was truly dysfunctional. There was a lot of violence, a lot of difficulty, a lot of hatred. The mother-in-law was a very despicable person who, in a sense, treated everyone as an enemy. And beyond that, Leona's husband demonstrated more and more that he had no commitment at all to her and their daughter. And as a result of that, Leona took matters into her hands, and she packed up her daughter, and they moved back to be closer to her family. And they took up residence in a little town called Pine Level, Alabama. After that experience, she saw a little of her dad, and she grew up pretty much in a single parent family. The family also attended the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which had been founded by Richard Allen in Philadelphia. It was a denomination that had a very strong social commitment to it, as well as a deeply religious one. And her grandfather once again reemerged as her mentor. And what did he teach her? Nightly, he sat her down and he told her the stories of the slave camps. He made her aware of her history, where he had been, from whom she had come. He taught her her history. He taught her something else. He taught her that in light of her history, she needed to understand the necessities of preparation. And so think about this. A little child of 7 years of age was taught by her grandfather that when you go to bed at night, you always wear your clothes. Because should the Ku Klux Klan come in the night, you need to be dressed and ready to flee. Oh, and she saw something else too. While grandfather was a man of prayer and a man of the Bible, he was also a man who kept his double-barrel shotgun very close to him. And he often shared with her that while he could not protect the entirety of the family, he could get the first one through the door. Her grandfather was a man of curious talents. He taught her the whole picture. You got to be ready when difficulty knocks. Beyond that, he taught her this. Coming out of your tradition, you come from a people who have learned how to forgive. Early on, Rosa was put to work in the cotton fields of Alabama. And the lesson that is learned there is very poignant. The children were taken out early, often before dawn, and began to pick the crop. They stood barefoot in that hot, burning sun. And when their feet became blistered and sore and raw, they worked on their knees, picking the crop. And even as they were faced with that kind of adversity, they persevered. And Rosa, because of her mother's tutelage, went off to school, a black school, where she learned her alphabet and her numbers and something of her educational background. And on her way to school every day, racism was constantly present. For while she was journeying off to attend the segregated black school, she had to walk through the white neighborhoods. And there she was called the N-word. Oftentimes there she was attacked. She realized that racism, while she did not know the word, was alive and well. During that period in her life, she developed two scripture verses, which became the bulwark of her living. Here's the first one. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And here's the second one. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Isn't that interesting that a child would choose two verses so freighted? Once again, her mother realized how important it was for Rosa to be taught. And so at the age of 11, she was sent to Miss White's School for Girls. I'll say that again, Miss White's School for Girls. The interesting thing about that school was this: every teacher, every mentor in the program was white. Every kid in the class was black. It was one of those schools, almost a finishing kind of school, where little black girls were taught the following disciplines. Number one, they were taught how to cook. They were taught how to keep a house. They were taught how to care for the sick. They were taught to care for their elders. And always in Miss White's School for Girls, they were taught scripture and prayer, and they were forbade to participate in any kind of dancing, and they were never to go to a movie. The most important thing about Miss White's school was this: those little girls, in addition to learning those life skills, learned an important lesson. The lesson was that they were persons of dignity, that they were persons of self-respect. And early on, Rosa realized that she did not have to settle for a life that was less than simply because she was Black. Oh, and there was another lesson in this school. When she was 15, just 4 years after beginning, the school was burned to the ground by the Ku Klux Klan, who left their mark so that everyone would know who was responsible. Her mother saw to it that she was able now to go to the Booker T. Washington Junior High School, where she completed the 10th grade. And then she went on to finish her high school work at the Laboratory School of the Alabama Teachers College for Negroes. While she was there, her grandma became ill. And as a result of that, she had to drop out and she never finished her schooling. She was called home to care for grandma. Those are the early years of Rosa Parks, filled with all kinds of reasons why she should have failed, why she should have not been accomplished. But also, they are years that are filled with lessons and people that made a difference. That difference continued when in 1931, at the age of 18, she met a man whose name was Raymond Parks. Raymond Parks. They would ultimately marry. He was 10 years older than she. He was a barber by trade, and on the weekends, he was the sexton of the local AME church. More importantly, Raymond Parks was a charter member of the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP. And one of the things that Rosa Parks in her biography, My Story, talks about in terms of remembering the first time she met Raymond was that there was not an ounce of meekness in him. And what did that mean? You know what it means. He did not settle for being called boy. He was a man who did not step off the curb when he encountered a white pedestrian. He was a man who had self-respect and dignity. He was a man who was involved in the issues of civil rights. And interestingly enough, it was because of her relationship to her husband, Raymond Parks, that Rosa Parks first began to see civil rights as an issue that needed to be addressed. In the book that David Brickley wrote, he talks about how it was that one of the very first things she saw in her husband's skill had to do with a group of boys. They had been charged with raping two white prostitutes. And of course, in that culture and in that era, any kind of sexual crime committed by a Black against a white was immediately adjudicated at its highest levels. And so these boys were automatically pronounced guilty, and they were sentenced to death. Now, you got to get the picture here. This is normative behavior for that culture. This is a done deal. This is not something that's going to seek appeal. And yet Raymond Parks decided that he would raise money that would be utilized to bring justice for these boys. And as a result of that, guess what? All eight of them never died. Four of them were ultimately freed without serving any time at all. And the remaining four only served 10 years each. Just think about that. Raymond Parks, a barber, a sexton, but a man who did not have an ounce of weakness or meekness in him, raised enough money to free eight Black boys. Oh, and he did something else. After they married in 1932, one of the very first things that he suggested to his wife, Rosa, was this: you need to finish your education. And so Rosa Parks, at the invitation of her husband, Raymond, went back to school at the age of 20. And she finished her high school diploma. However, that was not enough. That was not enough. It reminded me of my experience in graduate school when I knew it was privileged to know a fellow whose name was Willis Reed. Reed was a man of enormous abilities. He went on to become a member of the Congress. He's also responsible for building the Negro Education Emergency Education Organization. And he told the story of how it was that as we were in graduate school in Madison, New Jersey, one afternoon he went down to get his haircut. And he went into the barbershop and sat down. Two men ahead of him went into the chair. Three men who had come in after him went to the chair. And finally he raised his hand. And he asked when it was his turn. Barber responded using the N-word, never. As a result of that, many of us got behind Willis and we decided to make an issue of it. And I remember sitting in a room one night with him and he shared with us his history. And this is how it sounded. He said, you know, my grandfather was a sharecropper. He worked hard. And yet, the people around him said, N, you need to get clean. And so he said, my grandfather got clean and he raised my father to be clean as well. When my father went for a job, they said to him, you need to get education. And so he did, but he never got a job. And then Willis said these words, here I am, clean, educated, and I can't get my hair cut. That was the experience of Rosa Parks. Faithful, a Christian, educated, and she could not get a job. And so she began to take in sewing. She became a seamstress, and after a while, she worked as an aide in the local hospital. And eventually, she became a secretary at the Maxwell Army Air Force Base in Alabama. And while she was there, guess what? The reality of racism continued in her life. Traveling to and from work on the bus was a real trip because Montgomery buses were segregated. And that meant that Black people went into the front door of the bus, paid their fare, got off the bus, and came around and got in through the back door. It also meant that they only sat wherever it was for coloreds were permitted. And so she went back and forth to work every day in that kind of an environment. And here was the kicker. While she was on the base, because of the work of the government and primarily Franklin Delano Roosevelt, desegregating the military. She was able to go wherever she chose and wherever she pleased. And she began to see the dichotomy, the two worlds that were out there for her, a world of segregation, bitterness, and racism, a world of opportunity and equal treatment. Her life in Montgomery as an adult was difficult. For example, at the hospital, there were two kinds of elevators. Elevators for Blacks, elevators for whites. For Rosa Parks in that hospital, there were two kinds of restrooms, for Blacks and for whites. And never did a Black go into a white restroom or use a white elevator. And to show you the kind of spine that she was developing, guess what? Rather than using elevators, she walked the stairs. Rather than using the Black restroom, she would actually go home if she needed the facilities. Racism became a reality for this woman. Everywhere she went, there it was. A man by the name of E.D. Nixon, he was a porter on the railroad. He also became the man who founded the Porters Union. And they became interested in getting the vote for Black Americans. Somehow, Raymond Parks and E.D. Nixon became friends. And out of that friendship, Rosa Parks decided it was time for her to vote. I'd just like to share with you some of the hurdles that she faced. Here's the first one. She had to always find out when the registration bureau was open. Because you see, in that culture, in order to keep Black people from voting and registering for voting, the Bureau of Voting Affairs often changed their times of operation so that Blacks could not know when they were closed or opened. Oh, and here's something else. You had to take a kind of a social science test in order to get a voting card. When a Black person took that test, all they ever received back was a pass or fail notice. They never saw their test or its answers again. And so what did Rosa Parks do? She began to sleep near the Bureau of Voting Registration in Montgomery so that she would always be available when the doors opened. And then on the third time, we're taking the test to get the card. She took a picture of her test before she turned it in. Guess what? On the third try, she passed. And she was given the opportunity to vote. That experience of going through the voting process gave her a little bit of history. And part of that history was that as early as 1920, there had been boycotts of the Montgomery transit system occurring. Most of them had been pretty quickly extinguished. Why? Because in the city of Montgomery, Alabama, bus drivers, are you ready for that? In the city of Montgomery, Alabama, bus drivers carried guns, and they were officially granted police powers. And so as Rosa Parks boarded the bus each week, each day, going to and from her work, she became mindful that that was a place that had been tried to be somehow desegregated, but had failed. She had an encounter with a man whose name was James Blake. Remember that name if you can, James Blake. She was getting on the bus. She paid her fare after she got on the bus door at the front, and then he expected her to get off and come in through the back door. She refused, calling his attention to the fact she had paid her money and she was going to take her seat. Being a young woman, a young Black woman, as that confrontation escalated, she decided that the better part of valor was to withdraw. Remember that name. James Blake. In 1943, coming off of all of those experiences, at Raymond's indication, she attended her first AACP meeting in Montgomery, Alabama. She was the only woman there. And because she was the only woman, she was elected secretary. Yep, you got that. She was elected secretary. And as a result of that election, what did she do? Well, she wrote articles for the organization. She also, of course, kept the minutes. She answered the telephone from time to time. And beyond even that, there was no pay. But she kept track of something else. She kept track of all of the encounters on Montgomery buses between Black and white individuals. She became knowledgeable of the reality of that expression of racism. Being secretary was not enough for Rosa Parks. And so she became involved in something that was known as the Youth Council. It was an extension of the NAACP. The Youth Council utilized people who were willing to take the risk, go to the white library that was funded by public tax dollars, and take out books that in turn were shared with Black children. Rosa Parks was a part of that organization. Why? because she realized that education mattered. Oh, and you remember E.D. Nixon, the porter who organized the union? She began to volunteer at his office as well. And there she met a woman whose name was Virginia Durr, D-U-R-R. Virginia Durr was a white person. Her husband was an attorney. Both of them were prominent citizens in Montgomery, Alabama. And both of them were interested in civil rights. It was Virginia Durr who began to educate Rosa Parks about the tactics of dealing with racism. In 1954, of course, there was that great decision of Brown versus the Board of Education when public school segregation was outlawed, declared unconstitutional, and the Black community began to sense some momentum toward justice. A year later, in 1955, Rosa Parks attended a national gathering of the NAACP in Nashville, Tennessee, where once again, Virginia Durr was helpful in terms of enabling her to become conversant about tactics for dealing with racism. Coming back from Nashville, Tennessee, now armed with a sense of purpose and direction, she finally got a job at the Montgomery Fair department store. There she was the assistant tailor. The assistant tailor. And that's important to remember because one night in December of 1955, Rosa Parks left her job at the Montgomery Fair department store serving as the assistant tailor, where she had worked for 8 hours standing on her feet. She went to get on a bus to get home. The line was long. And so she decided to take a later bus. She went down to Lee's store. It was a little kind of a cut-rate drugstore to do some Christmas shopping. And when she finished her work of shopping, she went back out to get the later bus. It came. She got on the bus and sat down in the wrong section. It was only then that she realized that the driver of that bus, ironically, was James Blake, the man with whom she had had an encounter 12 years earlier. He came back and insisted that she get out of that seat and take a place back in the colored section. She refused. An encounter developed. Ultimately, the police were called and two beat cops, ending their shift, arrived. They both pleaded with Rosa Parks, come on, just go back and sit down. Her response was infamous. I will not. I am tired of being pushed around. And so the beat cops had no choice but to arrest her. But they did not handcuff her. They took her back to the courthouse where they filled out all of the arrest forms. She asked for a drink of water and it was denied. She was then put in a squad car, still uncuffed, and taken to the jail where she was fingerprinted and photographed, still uncuffed. And after the process was finished, she once again asked for a drink of water. It was denied. She was then given this option. Do you want to be in a cell by yourself, or do you want to be in a cell with two other Black ladies? She chose the latter because, you see, the teachings of Miss White's school emerged. Maybe one of them needed some care. She ultimately was given her phone call and she called home. And this was her curt message to her husband, Raymond. I'm in jail. Of course, he immediately panicked, wondering if she had been abused, if there had been any indiscretion expressed toward her. She assured him she was well, but she asked that he call Virginia Durr. And within a matter of minutes, the Durrs arrived at the jail of Montgomery, Alabama. The process for having her released was implemented, and within 2 hours, because a white attorney had come to her aid, along with his white wife. That made the difference. Ultimately, Rosa Parks was fired from her job. She was fired from her job at the Montgomery Fair department store. The city began to crack down on people who were objecting to the way they were being treated. And eventually, a man by the name of Martin Luther King decided that Rosa Parks would be an excellent trial case for ending the segregation of the bus system in Montgomery. That's interesting, because earlier on, King had rejected the concept of dealing with a young woman whose name was Claudette Davis. She was a teenager who had gotten on a bus and refused and kind of made a mess of herself. She was belligerent and hostile, et cetera. They rejected her. Rosa Parks was selected as the trial case to end the segregation of the Montgomery system. You see, she had done nothing wrong, excepting to be Black. You all know the story. Ultimately, the Black community of Montgomery, Alabama, because of the efforts of Rosa Parks, entered into a boycott of the bus system in that city. It lasted 381 days. And what that meant was that most of Black Americans living in that city had to find other means of transportation to get to work. 90% of the riders of the Montgomery bus system were Black. And what did the community do? They organized a kind of a taxi system. And they determined places where people could wait for someone to pick them up and take them to work. For 381 days, because Rosa Parks had said, "I'm being tired of pushed around," the Black community rallied. And ultimately, the Supreme Court, a year later, pronounced that segregation on public transit was unconstitutional. Now, that victory had costs to it. A young Black pregnant woman exiting a bus was shot and killed. A young teenager getting off of a bus was attacked and brutally beaten. Segregation in terms in other areas of the city, the water fountains, et cetera, were now vigorously enforced. And best of all, the city made it a public ordinance that you could not gather in groups of more than two on street corners, trying to end, you see, the taxi system. Nevertheless, the boycott of the Montgomery bus system was successful, and it ended segregation. Martin Luther King was the pastor at the Dexter Avenue Church during that era. And you may remember having read that his door in his house were bombed because of his involvement in that reality. The same things happened to the Parkses. They were threatened. Their house was shot. And eventually they decided that they would need to move. And so she gathered up her ill mother and they moved to Detroit, Michigan, hoping to find some security and safety. She continued to speak out against racial bias. And eventually she was hired in Hampton, Virginia by the Hampton Institute. The Hampton Institute was an organization that was interested in trying to help people learn to live together. She missed her family too much. And so eventually she moved back to Detroit to join Raymond and her mother, who were there. As the 60s dawned, for Rosa Parks, in spite of all of the success that she had had, a season of sadness emerged. The first sadness was when she learned that Martin Luther King had been shot. The second sadness was when she learned that Robert Fitzgerald Kennedy had been shot. The sadness continued as her husband Raymond died of cancer shortly after her mother. And she lost her beloved brother, Sylvester, to the same disease. Suddenly, all of the joy, victory, and happiness that Rosa Parks had known paled. But guess what? In that book, My Story, that she wrote, this is what she says. At the depths of my despair, I remembered, the Lord is my shepherd. In the depths of my despair, I remembered, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? And so what did Rosa Parks do? Well, in 1987, she founded something called the Rosa Raymond Parks Institute for Self-Development. It picked up on all of the lessons that she had learned in Miss White's school for girls. Well, now it was extended across the entirety of the city of Detroit. She also established something known as the Rosa Parks Scholarship Foundation. And that was simply an organization that enabled her to channel money that she earned by way of speaking engagements and the writing of several books into the lives of young Black people so they could go to college. She became a force for social change and earned the title of being called the mother of the civil rights movement. She gained notoriety beyond belief. In Montgomery, Alabama, where she had instigated the boycott of the bus system, the city council actually changed the name of Cleveland Avenue to the Rosa Parks Boulevard. The bus on which she refused to leave her seat was purchased and now can be seen in the Henry Ford Museum in Detroit, Michigan. In 1990, Nelson Mandela came to the city of Detroit. Quite naturally, she was a part of the party to greet and welcome him. And as Nelson Mandela, you remember that story, embraced Rosa Parks, raising his hand, he began to shout, "Rosa, Rosa, Rosa." And the entirety of that community gathered with him in that chant. In 1993, Rosa Parks bought an airplane ticket to Stockholm, where she received the Nobel Peace Prize. And then in 1994, a young Black man whose name was Joseph Skipper broke into her apartment, demanded money from her, and then beat her brutally. He was ultimately arrested, tried, and incarcerated. And during the entirety of that experience, guess what Rosa Parks did? That's right. She prayed for him, remembering the admonition of her grandfather that we are to love our enemies. Across those years, she did a number of things that are noteworthy. She attended Black Power events. Now, you got to understand that. Black power had become a very controversial notion. It was kind of violent. It kind of led to some very difficult things. But why did she participate? Because she wanted to end apartheid in South Africa. She also became a part of a lobbying group that lobbied to have Martin Luther King's birthday become a national holiday, which was obviously successful. At the age of 82, she participated in the Million Man March in the city of Washington, D.C. And in 1996, she was invited to come to the Clinton White House, where the president awarded her the Medal of Honor, highest civilian rank, merit badge that can be given. Rosa Parks died on October the 24th, 2005, after a somewhat extended illness, her body in a casket, laid in state in the Capitol Rotunda. She was the first woman ever to be so honored, and only the second African American to be honored. President Clinton attended her funeral service, as did a young senator from Illinois. His name was Barack Obama. There was also another woman who was there. Her name was Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State. As Ms. Rice was leaving the ceremony, she was interviewed by the press. And this is what she said. "I would not be standing here today, and you would not be interested in what I have to say if it were not for Mrs. Park." Let me end by sharing with you a couple of her fundamental Christian beliefs. Her faith was practical and realistic. She learned that from her grandpap, who carried that double-barreled shotgun. She decided to leave Montgomery when she realized it was unsafe. And following the attack of Joseph Skipper, she moved to the 25th floor of her apartment building, mindful that her life was always in danger. Yes, she loved her enemies, but she could fiercely oppose them and resisted their evil. She never wandered very far from the discipline of prayer, which she had learned in that Alabama house back on that farm. She was always mindful that God would sustain her and keep her in the moments of danger. She was a woman of peace, but she was also a woman of resistance. If you remember nothing from these comments, remember these. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? Rosa Parks, the mother of the civil rights movement. I think I better stop there and get some questions. Anybody have a comment or a question you need to make? Put you all to sleep, right? Oh, well, back there it is. Got a question back there, Ted. Battery moment.
That what you've done has brought us closer to my life. And you've done it as an early part of Rosa Parks. But I certainly was a part of it. And I found that really.
Yeah. You know, that's a recurring theme that one encounters when one talks about not only issues relevant to race, but numerous kind of sociological concerns that have been a part of our culture, in that we now have people who are still alive who remember and participated in those kinds of moments. This past semester, I taught a course at the college, History of the Black Church in America. And one afternoon, one of the students raised his hand, and he began to talk about how it was that his grandfather had talked with him about some of the stuff that I was lecturing on in terms of the history of the Black Church. This, his grandpap had lived through it. And I think that that's kind of an important legacy for our time. We need to know our history. You know, David McCullough, unfortunately recently died. He once said that there are two things we don't do well in America. We don't communicate, which I find interesting. And number two, we don't remember our history. And I think if we could do both to some degree of effectiveness, some issues might be addressed. Question.
I have kind of an unfinished thought, and you may be an exception to this. But it seems to me that I'm in a men's group here. We get together and discuss issues. There's one Black person who's in the group. a pastor, and he makes such a difference. And sort of what your Rosa Parks, her history and all that, makes me think that what's missing in our dialogue among Christians is the Black voice. The Black voice. It's different from the white voice. Not like I'm saying you're an exception here. But it's just a thought that if our dialogue, our Christian dialogue, included the Black voice, it would be a lot better.
It's interesting you raised that. Just let me share a response to that that comes from James Cone, C-O-N-E, a respected Black theologian, responsible for developing some concepts such as Black theology, redefining what Black power ultimately means. Black, you know, he said that Black power is not about guns and violence. Black power is about becoming who you should be. He once said that part of the reason for the absence of the Black voice in the dialogue that is so important is the fact that when you talk about dialogue, you have to talk about the mutuality of respect. And that over the centuries of sadness in this area of race relations, unfortunately, the Black community has not always received that respect. I think that's changing. It's different. And I think you got to be careful because that also can become a reason for abdication. But I do think it's a valid observation to make. And in my experience, for about 20 years, I did a show at Channel 4. It was called In Good Faith. And there were several of us that comprised the panel. There was Jack, who was a white face. There was Gail King, who was associated with this parish, who was a female. There was Rabbi from the Tree of Life Synagogue, Alvin Birkin. And then there was Jay Orsett. He was the pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church up on the hill. And it was always amusing to me that whenever Jay spoke, on or off camera, he really spoke with authority. And one day I said to Jay, after he invited me to come up to his church, he called me on the phone one day and he said, "Hey, Operly, our church is going to celebrate Race Relations Sunday and we're looking for a white guy to come and preach. How about coming up?" So I did. And it was kind of a curious thing because when I was finished, he took me aside and he said, "You know, I'm really disappointed." "Why, Jay? What did I do?" He said, "You preach more like a Black guy than a white guy." But I finally said to Jay, "Why are you always so aggressive?" And that his response was, "Because if I'm not, people don't take me seriously." Now, we need to obviously mature and get beyond those kinds of that kind of thinking, but I think it's something to ponder about. And it's here's the other thing that's important to say, though. Yeah, maybe it'd be better to have more than one Black preacher involved in your group. But isn't it good that you have a group? Isn't it meaningful that you've got some people coming together around those issues?
Just to comment on that, only one Black. I've made the point that it's like a piano. You have all these white keys and not enough Black keys. And, you know, without the Black keys, you don't get the right something in your music.
Can't make chords. Yeah,
what's interesting about this Black guy that you talked about was that, in fact, just last Tuesday, we asked him when you showed up, and he's what? Been coming more than a year, I think. What did you expect, and then what did you find? And he joined us very skeptically. And now he says it's the most therapeutic experience he has in his week. And he just never imagined that a group of 15 white guys would treat him with this kind of respect, this kind of equality. And as you might expect, he adds a great deal and he understands that we value that. Mm-hmm. So he benefits.
Sure.
Every bit as much as we do.
One of the things that I that I wrestle with in any kind of dialogue that involves people who have been historically different, okay, is that ultimately we all need to move a little bit. And what I mean by that is, I was privileged to have a relationship with a Catholic priest, John Haney. I don't know, maybe some of you might have known John. He was the pastor down at the Whitehall Catholic Church. John taught me so much about Catholicism. Not about the doctrine, because I already had that. I knew that. I learned what it was like to be a priest. For example, one day he came into my office and he slumped down in a chair and I thought he was sick. And after a few moments of silence, I said to him, John, are you okay? He said, no, not really. And he went on to talk to me about how difficult it was for him as a priest to be dealing with the tragedy of the sex scandals and then the cover-up that had invaded the Catholic Church and was going on at that time. I had never thought about that. I never had that perspective until John raised it for me. And it opened up for me a whole new appreciation. I think we need to be when we're involved with each other who are around differences, I think it's important that we all realize we can all learn something from each other. And obviously your group is doing something very right. Yeah, and we've got one back there too, Dave.
Well, what's particularly powerful about our group is we focus on our weaknesses.
There you go.
So humility is the order of the day. And that's for many of the men around the tables, that's the first time they've ever done that.
Yep.
And it's incredibly therapeutic, as you might imagine.
Yep.
At work a couple of years ago, I work for PNC. We formed very intentional groups of diversity. You know, it wasn't necessarily black and white, but just diverse. And I appreciate the comment about communication and inviting people in. And I think I've probably grown up a little bit in the last few years thinking about, I used to think I understood what it was like to be a black person in the United States. I had no idea. It was my thinking that was forming those stories. But when you invite people of color to tell their own stories, you learn way more than you would ever know in your own mind. You know, just hearing the story, it was, I really did not understand what it was like to be black. I thought I did, you know, because you read it in a book, but to hear the stories and to hear the fear that they lived with grace and humility, but the fear was real, and we never talk about that.
I learned that from a student of mine. This has been maybe 10 or 15 years ago, a young black fellow, just a quality young guy. In fact, he's going on to medical school. One afternoon, we were sitting in my office, and he said to me, Doc, do you ever have the talk with your kids? I was like, what do you mean, the talk? Well, then he went on to tell me, every black family who is meeting their responsibilities ultimately has a talk with a teenage, primarily boy, young man. And what is the purpose of the talk? If you ever get pulled over by a police officer, do exactly what they tell you to do. Put your hands on the wheel. Don't smart back. They tell you to get out of the car, get out of the car. They tell you to stay in the car, stay in the car. Because, as he went on to say to me, my mom and dad had lived in the constant fear of, there he was attending a small Catholic liberal arts college in the middle of Westmoreland County. He also had a vehicle. And they were just absolutely panic-stricken that he might be out on the road some night and either to his own doing or perhaps not to any doing of his own, encounter a situation where his life could be taken over a broken taillight. I didn't even know that phrase existed, the talk. But boy, it does. And it's reality. In a lighter note, that same young man also had a conversation with me one day about whether or not I thought it'd be okay for him to date a white girl. That's a pretty powerful question. And so I said to him, well, it's a very complex question. Let me answer it in a couple of ways. If you're asking me, Jack Opperly, whether or not it's okay or not okay, my answer is, of course it's okay. If you behave yourself, conduct yourself with dignity, of course. I said, now I have to share with you the fact that, you know, not every environment allows that. And I went on to tell him that when I was a student at Shenley High School back in the 50s, because we were a multicultural community, interracial dating was no big deal. And I kind of went on about that. And I compared that to where he was, where it was a big deal. And he thought about all that. And he said, well, Doc, thanks for your time. And he said, thanks for sharing your experience with me. But he said, I do have one question. I said, what's that? He said, so, is Mrs. Opperly black? He just assumed off of my response, you know, that I had dated, married, and had a black wife. We need to have those experiences. You have another comment, please, sir?
I just want to share two things. So I was in a seminary, and I left, Catholic seminary. And one of my classmates who also left told me, I left the seminary because of poverty, chastity, and obedience. I got married, now I have all three. And the other story, I was in my office one day, I'm a lawyer, and this lady called me and we were talking, and she was black, and she said, you know, I can't stand white people. And I thought I knew what she meant, and I said, you know, I can't stand them either. And then she said, well, can I come in and see you? And then I thought, oh my gosh, what did I just do? She's going to come in here and see that I'm white. So I sort of got over that. We got along, but I thought that was interesting that I responded in that way.
If you want to read what we don't know about racism, read the biography of Roberto Clemente. We celebrate him as one of the Berg's heroes, great baseball player, magnificent humanitarian, a guy who spoke his mind, et cetera, et cetera. But when you read his biography, you realize what it was like for Roberto Clemente as a young player in Florida, how it was that the white guys rode around on a bus and Joe Brown had bought a station wagon that the black players of color rode around in, and how it was that when they went to restaurants, the white players would go in and order and eat, and they would bring takeout for the black or colored guys, men of color, and so forth. And in that book, there is a humorous note. Finally, Clemente had enough of that. And he said to Joe Brown, you can sell the car. I'm going in with them to eat in the restaurant. And so he went in and sat down at the restaurant, and the waiter came and said to him, I'm sorry, sir. We don't serve blacks here. And Roberto Clemente sat in his seat and said, you do now. Pretty good idea. You do now. I think Ted's getting my attention.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, you know, I think it's worth noting that churches are one of the most segregated places in America, of course. And we go to a segregated church. You know, we're sitting in one right now. Now, you know, it's not by policy, it's just by fact. Likewise, schools are just about as segregated as they've ever been. I went to public school at a time when integration was, you know, really in an active phase. And I went to, you know, you describe a multicultural community. I went to a Southern school district that was being integrated, and kind of watched that go from a 40% black school to a mostly black school in the South as the white families left either for the county schools, which were still predominantly white, or the Christian school, which didn't admit black people, or the private school for the wealthier families, which did not admit Black people. And yet we're here in a very good school district that is, by fact, segregated.
One of the things that is important to say is that racism is systemic. And just whenever you think racism or sexism, any kind of bias or prejudice, just when you think those things have been addressed, they mutate and they find other ways to accomplish their objectives. And we need to, that's why dialogue and conversation and that wonderful comment you made about admitting our weaknesses becomes so important. Because George Kelsey taught at Drew University in ethics. He was a big Black man who, when he walked into a room, you paid attention. He was a brilliant scholar. And he once said to us, "Your work will never be finished." And he's right. And then you add into that all kinds of complications. Not every Black person in America is a stand-up guy. And if we're talking about equality, I think from time to time we have to acknowledge that as well. It's a terribly complex issue that is best served by the groups that you described here this morning, as small or as large as they may be, as effective or ineffective as they may be. At least you're coming together, and it sounds like to me like something is happening of a positive nature. Yeah.
To your point about racism finding a way.
Yeah.
The one thing I've learned in the last 5 or 10 years is that humans can rationalize anything.
Yep.
Literally anything.
I think that's a good button on this conversation. Anybody else have anything to offer? Well, next week we're going to wrap up this terrible trip by talking about Mother Teresa, one of the most significant Catholic figures of our time. And one of the most significant theological voices, I think, of the ages. So Mother Teresa, right next week. Thank you very much.